1,000 horsepower per ton. Which is twice the power to weight of a Bugatti Veyron, which is the fastest car. I don't do any drawing, very, 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 very few drawings. No CAD, no CAM, no computers, no nothing. Just a guy in the garage, pick a piece of metal and start cutting.
That is phenomenal.
At one point, the helmet pulled round, twisted round. I was looking for the air breathing vent.
No.
There's a little slit in the front of my helmet. I wasn't actually looking through the visor. I was looking for the head, because the pressure on your face is tremendous at that speed.
Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, helping you save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Right, Pruts, we've got a great guest today. This is a gentleman that many of you will recognise from television's programmes such as Junk and Disorderly, The Motorbike Show, Shed and Bury, Fix It, Flog It. Sorry, Find It, Fix It, Flog It. And he is also a YouTube sensation, an engineering god. Like, listen, the bikes this man makes are so well known. He is absolutely a legend in the biking world. Is, of course, Mr. Alan Milliard. Hi, Alan.
Hi, yeah, thanks very much for the invite.
An engineering god.
Yeah.
That's some place to start, isn't it? Alan, thank you so much for joining us, mate.
I will say, perhaps, with me and my engineering skills, the bar is very low. So when I say engineering god, you to me, perhaps, if you can pick up a socket set, an engineering god. But Alan is, let's be honest, we'll talk about some of the bikes you've made, but we are in engineering royalty today.
Mm. I never see myself as a royalty or god. I just do what I just make what I see and see what I make.
Well, I mean, that sums... I mean, not saying we've got to stop the podcast now, Alan, but that absolutely sums it up perfectly, doesn't it, given what we see from you and all these wonderful, wonderful shows. I mean, what comes through abundantly is that love, of course, of machinery, of technology, of the way engineering works, but it's the motorbikes, isn't it, that comes through and your love of them in every single way, shape and form. Where does that come from? Has it been passed down? Is it in your bones? Where does it all start for you?
I've always been interested in engines and bikes right from a very early age, probably as early as probably 10 years old. And I always wanted like a moped or a motorbike to ride around the garden. My dad would never let me have one because he's fine, I was going to hurt myself. So I settled with lawnmowers initially, like Suffolk Punch lawnmowers and Atco lawnmowers, and getting the engines to ride and cut the grass. I used to love cutting the grass. In fact, we used to cut the grass 3 times a week just so I could run the lawnmower engine. Any excuse to start the engine up and get it working.
I used to love cutting my parents' garden, and also I was very lucky enough to have a little scrambler when I was a kid, but I wouldn't know how to change even a spark plug or anything. But it sounds to me you were destined to have a career in taking things apart and putting them back together even better. In terms of the television work, how did that kick off for you then? Was it just through the love of engineering someone spotted you, or how did it work?
Basically, I was at Salon Privé, which is like a big concourse event in London, Salon House, with my Dodge Viper V10. Mm-hmm. And one of the judges was Henry Cole. No, he wasn't a judge. He was there filming the motorbike show. We were having a little bit of chat about stuff. And I said, what's the chance of getting on the motorbike show? He said, well, you can do some work in the background first if you want, do some restoration work. So I did some restoration work on that overflow stuff they couldn't do in-house. And eventually I started gradually creeping on camera a little bit more to the situation I'm in today.
A little bit about that surprises me, Alan, only because... we've chatted just before we came on here and chatting now. There's a certain difference in approach from yourself and Henry, isn't there? You know what I mean? We've had Henry on here. It's all action. It's a mile a minute. And the composure that you show when it comes to talking about him, when it comes to dealing with him in all the different shows that you do, the dynamic of that is what makes it absolutely fascinating. So to know that it was you that kind of went, Henry, you were obviously very confident in what you could do to get yourself in that position where you're saying, what about a chance on telly? Was that a bit of a leap for you at the time, or did you think, well, why wouldn't I be on a show with Henry Cole?
It was totally out of my comfort zone, really, being in front of a camera. But I just wanted to be involved even in the background would be great, just being involved. It's a good team spirit, and everyone's a laugh. Nothing's rehearsed. It's just literally spontaneous each day. We go in the morning, we don't know what we're going to be doing, or what vehicles. Who's going to say what, when it's going to be said, what jokes are going to be said. It's completely spontaneous, which is what makes it cool. But quite often, a lot of stuff can't be actually shown on television.
What, with Henry? I can't believe that for a second, Alan.
But it's all kept in for other things, like his live shows he's doing, his show on his stage shows. It's just every minute is funny.
I love almost like your innocence with it, in terms of, you know, you just sort of, I'll have a little background role and you don't sort of crave the limelight, but yet your YouTube channel and so forth is absolutely huge. I mean, that crossover, I mean, people don't watch TV as much as they used to. It is all online and stuff. And you seem to have gone to the new, you know, the new generation would be aware of you because of the huge numbers you get on YouTube with every film you put out. Do you almost just feel that, not just you live in a dream, but do you have a bit of freedom, creative freedom now? The fact that, you know, your work speaks for itself. People want to see your builds. Does that mean you're getting to live the dream and do what you want?
It is in some respects, yeah. I mean, my videos, they're just genuine videos. I film what I'm doing at the time. Like Tracy's doing her cooking some cupcakes, that gets filmed. The hedgehogs are in the garden, the birds, pigeons, anything that lands gets filmed. And it all gets interlaced into the actual video itself. I get so many comments from people that say, I'm not really interested in motorbikes, but I love your videos. I love watching the cakes being cooked and the birds and the wildlife. And that's what makes it sort of splits it up and makes it interesting for everybody.
I think as well, Alan, it's that sense of what the greatest strength with it is. And I mean this totally as a compliment, is that sense of normality. And when you've got, as Ewan's kind of attesting to, 300,000 subscribers, 55 million views. Maybe that just reinforces potentially what a platform such as YouTube is, which is you can watch it in your own time, you can watch it anywhere on the move, and you can kind of ingest it when you want to. You know what I mean? So people come to it very, very naturally, it seems, and stick with it, don't they?
To me, it's all over my head. I don't realize how good it actually is. Like, people tell me all the time how cool it is, the amount of views I got and the subscriber account I've got. But to me, it's just, I make a video for people to watch.
That's the coolest thing, Ewan. When someone's telling you how cool it is and you've just got that kind of, oh, is it? That's the sweet spot. That's where you want to be.
I never do any hard sell.
Maybe like you said, Prutz, in terms of you're just very normal and you're getting on and you're doing what you like doing. You happen to document it and put it out to the world to say, if you want to watch it, join in. And people love what you do because of that natural way you are, and it works. And you know, clearly YouTube is a source of income as well, so really you're making a living out of something you'd love doing anyway. So you know,
I think
it's brilliant what you're doing.
One thing I've done right from the beginning, I don't put music on my videos, because you end up upsetting a lot of people because your choice of music might not be someone else's choice of music. So all I have is my ticking clock, which gets a lot of people talking.
What you do as well, you often take a machine that someone like myself and Prutz would gladly own and ride and think, this is brilliant. It rides so well, it handles well, it pulls off well, it's great. And you take things apart and you put them back together better than the original manufacturer. I mean, you must have supreme confidence in what you do. Or is that just because of years on the spanners, you know what you're doing? You must have that God-given talent or the desire.
My dad always used to say to me, just have a go. Just have a go and save your... When you have a go, don't say, people say to you, no, you can't do that, that won't work, that's not possible. It gives me the impetus to even make it work even better. When I was making my V12 Kawasaki back in 2001, I made the V8, I went to Stafford Show, and some chap said, what are you going to do next? Like they always do. And I was on the mic. So I haven't really got an idea. And that person shouted out, make a V12 from the Z1, from the Z1300. And this chap who's next to him is an expert. I'm an expert in Z13. There's no way that can be done. It's not possible. Can't be done. So I said, I'll make it and I'll bring it here next year and rev it up outside. And that's what I did.
Brilliant.
It's staggering to think that, I mean, you hear it can't be done, and then possibly, Alan, you hear no. And in your head, all you hear is, well, yeah, of course I can. Why wouldn't I be able to do that? And the challenge that's there, the passion that comes with it. What was the first thing you got your hands on to think, I'm going to either rebuild, customize, or make it my own? Because as we know, as motorcycle culture evolves and moves and grows in certain aspects, custom has become, it's got different connotations, hasn't it? You know what I mean? It can be all kinds of different things. But you've been doing custom by definition of making it to your own kind of standard and what you want for such a long time that it kind of transcends what is deemed fashionable, because customization is literally what you're doing, isn't it?
I never see my bikes as custom bikes or specials. I see them as recreated originals.
Nice.
Which is what I like to do. Right back to my very first bike I did when I was probably 10 or 11 years old, I had a Mobilette. mm-hmm. which is a 50cc French moped, and the engine blew up. I took the engine off my lawnmower, which was a Suffolk Punch 175, hung it underneath the frame, put on the belt, and it was the fastest bike out of all my friends' bikes when we used to go down the fields.
And it cut grass like no one's business.
Yeah, and it ran, it was four stroke, and it ran really, really great. You know, that was really cool. And then when I was 15, my dad was working on his Austin Mini and took the engine out to change it. I said, "Can I have your old engine?" He said, "What are you going to do with that?" So I put it in a motorbike. And he just laughed at me and let me go on. I fitted it into a BSA Bantam by cutting the bike in half and welding one half to the front and one half to the back. And I rode this thing around the local fields. I got caught by the police, had to go to court, lost endorsements on my license when I was 15. So when I got my license when I was 16, I had two endorsements.
Straight up. I mean, what makes you look at, obviously, with the one that you're talking there about having to cut the frame and weld it, but with the Mobilette and moving the lawnmower engine into it, do you just know that you look at both or you hear the sound of both or you kind of really investigate and you go, well, that obviously does that and can do that. So that will be able to do that if I transfer it and obviously connections and all that type of stuff. But how do you just know what fits what or do you know that you can make it fit?
I just see it. I just see it.
Wow.
A three-dimensional image in my mind.
No way.
I just see all the problems. When I was making a Viper bike, I could imagine myself riding down the road. I actually sat on the bike, driving down the road, thinking of all the problems I've got to resolve.
No.
With weight, and I don't do any drawing, very, 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 very few drawings. No CAD, no CAM, no computers, no nothing. Just I go out in the garage, pick a piece of metal, and start cutting.
That is phenomenal.
And nine times out of 10, I get it out right first time. I do occasionally make mistakes, like you're cutting an engine. Sometimes you might think, oh, I'm a bit close there, too far. Go and get another set of crankcases, start again. But most times I know where to cut, I just cut down.
You've got some gift. I've got to ask you, do you see dead people as well? seriously, you've got a gift there because, you know, I suppose maybe it's like an artist, you know, in his mind, he's got the vision of how he wants painting to turn out.
Exactly like that.
And he just goes with it. And you're obviously, you've got that creative side of your brain is a lot more active than mine certainly is. But I would look at that and think, oh my God, there's a problem there. And you're just looking at that as, there's no problems, just solutions. I'll put this there, that there. I mean, that's a lovely way to work, like just almost like freehand, just creating a masterpiece.
But most of my, nearly all my bikes I make, I try to make them as if they were made at the original factory, like my Kawasaki Z1 Super 6. It's as if Kawasaki should have made this bike. The Honda SS100, all the Kawasaki 4s and 5s. I put them back on original paint, as many original parts unmodified as possible on the bike to create the illusion of a factory bike.
Do manufacturers look at you when you come to a bike show and think, oh no, here he comes, he's going to be tearing us apart in his mind, you should have done it like this, you should have done it like this, and yeah.
My biggest compliment is the designer of the Z1, he just sadly died about 3 years ago. Narendra Tata, I think his name, I can't remember his name, he designed the Z1, he actually emailed me on Facebook, on Messenger, and thanked me for the Super 6, saying how well it was done.
Wow.
He said it was a nice homage to the original Ford design. He's actually said to me, they did have a six-cylinder air cooler on the drawing board that they may have made, but they decided to go down the water cooled route.
No way. The way that you mentioned that, Alan, or sorry, explained it, and I thought, again, Ewan's analogy was very good, Ewan, with regards to an artist seeing what an artist can picture and then visualise and put down on a canvas. Does that come from vast amounts of time researching what you love, reading about what you love, looking at...
Not really, no.
It's just literally something that you're just built that you can look at something and you know how it's meant to look.
Back in the 70s, when I was a child, we had no money. So I used to make things, you sort of taught to repair stuff, recycle stuff. I used to go to local rubbish tips to get stuff. I mean, you go down to a local rubbish tip in a nearby village, you pick up a whole Honda 250 Bentley, bring it back home and try and mend it, and it's a missing. You think, oh, I could take that bit off that old Triumph, that might fit. Yeah, that'll fit, that works perfectly. So it's make do amend sort of situation rather than just ringing up on the shop to get the latest part and just bolting it onto your bike, you know.
I tell you, your logo should just be simply born to build. Genuinely, you know, I could say I was born to run, he was born to kick a football about, but you've definitely got something in your mind different to how some people see, and it's genius. I know it's like picking a favourite child. We're going to get onto the white elephant in the room soon. For me, your best build ever. We'll get onto that monster of a bike. But do you have a favourite that you've built, be it even from your childhood? What one machinery are you most proud of?
it is really, really difficult. I tell people it's the one I'm riding on the day. Mm. But my little Velocette V-twin is lovely to ride. It's idyllic. It's silky smooth, really nice. Then the Flying Milliard is just ridiculously in your face, funny to ride. Makes you like everyone stops and takes pictures and laughs as you go by. The Viper V10 gives you a petrified, scary, laughy, excited, happy grin the whole time you're on it. It's just ridiculous to ride. I mean, one speed, 225 miles an hour, 600 kilograms, 550 brake horsepower, 500 pounds foot of torque, just to ring a few figures, you know, off it.
Alan, and again, I mentioned it earlier on, and it just you must see the duality to all this. This lovely, gentle, mild-mannered chap that we're chatting to here that makes motorbikes that could get you to the moon. And then shows people how to ride them as well. What is it? What's that gap in the middle? How does it go from that to the other?
I don't know. It's a very, very close line, isn't it?
Between genius and insanity.
It's just having a go and making what you see in your mind. Don't be put off by, I can't do this, I can't do that. I need this amount of money to make that, or I need this expertise. The classic thing you do, you ring up the expert, he'll say no.
Correct.
I mean, surely everyone, though, when you said I've got a Viper engine, an 8-litre V10, I'm going to make a bike out of that. I'm basically going to sit a bike on top of an engine, which is what it is. People must have thought, first of all, that can't be done. Secondly, you are bonkers. And third, who's going to ride it? You and Henry rode it. But I mean, you said earlier, you know, I don't really do custom. You can't get more custom than that. I mean, how did that idea come about? Because that is a monstrous size engine for a motorbike. Like you said, 500 brake horsepower and it weighs nothing. It's a death trap, touch wood, you could have it.
1,000 horsepower per ton.
Wow.
Which is twice the power to weight of a Bugatti Veyron, which is the fastest car.
And you first rode that and you turned it over and you got on and you rode it. Was that just pure fear? Pure, I've just got a helmet on? How were you feeling?
It's a bit of a story, really, because I got this thing all registered for the road in 2009, beginning something like the 1st of August. Took me 30 days. I didn't ride it to the 31st of August, and it's a bank holiday. And I finally plucked up enough courage to put it into gear and pull away out of my drive. But I went out onto the main road, went down the main road, and I thought I'd just turn around and come back. I couldn't turn around. It was so heavy. I had to go 30 miles down the road to a big enough roundabout so I could turn around and come back. It took me 6 months to become proficient at riding it, to the point where I could take it to the Ironman TT in 2012. So I rode it up to Liverpool docks, rode up onto the ferry in a force 9 gale.
No way.
And then did 4 days riding around, rode to the Ironman circuit, ran the TT circuit 3 or 4 times up over the hill, ran Ramsey hairpin was all sides of the road. You start on the left, finish on the right, like John McGuinness, but at half the speed.
Well, talk this idiot sat here, Alan, through. The reason, because of the size of the bike, the power of the bike or the physics of the bike, about being able to turn it around, did you just come up to a bend and think, right, I'm knackered here, I've got to keep going?
Fast sweeping bends are great because you just power it in and use the torque to power you through.
Yeah.
Slow stuff, you can lean it over about 3 degrees and you're on the side. So you see, you've got to look at the road. There's a pothole, only half the tire goes through it, pull the bike across.
No.
So you have to. What I normally do, I go out my pan-European and do a cycling lap where I'm going to ride it to make sure the road's okay.
Yeah.
Because with great power comes great responsibility. You know, I've done over 10,000 miles on this bike.
Wow.
And I've ridden it all over. I've been to the Isle of Wight, I've been to Guernsey, the island of Guernsey with a 20-mile speed limit. I've ridden it all around there.
I bet it scared the life out of people on Guernsey, didn't it?
Yeah, how on earth do you ride it at 20? How on earth does that go so slow, an engine like that? It just makes me ticking over.
Idle with clutch out is 36 miles an hour.
What?
It's 36 miles an hour. That's the slowest it'll run with the clutch right out.
So you're going around the island with a brake on all the time, not to get done for speeding. Yeah.
Covering the front brake and slipping the clutch, basically. But when it was tested by Motorcycle News in 2009, Bruce Dunn rode it. It's the fastest accelerating and fastest accelerating bike I've ever tested in 30 years of testing bikes. From 0 to 200. It didn't go into a curve. Because normally what happens is as you get to about 180 mile an hour, the wind resistance starts taking over with the drag. And you go into a curve, even this turbocharged Hayabusa Suzuki still go into the curve and slow down. This didn't, it just powered straight on. I mean, it got to 207 mile an hour and Bruce was literally getting dragged off the bike. He just shut the throttle.
So kind of define the laws of physics is basically what this bike does.
Yeah, and he's got all the data for it and he's overlaid it and there's nothing that comes anywhere near it from 120 to 200 miles an hour, that acceleration point.
And the fact that at 183 and a half miles an hour at Elvington Airfield, you've got Henry hanging on for dear life. What what happens there?
That day, I tell you, because I obviously got up really early in the morning. I didn't sleep all night. We stayed in the hotel at Elvington. But the thought of taking a very valuable passenger on the back, his TV presenter, and Janie said to me, look after my husband. So his wife has sort of put all that responsibility onto me, bring him back in one piece. We're going to sit on a homemade bike and take it up to 180 miles an hour to beat the world record for pillion, which we actually did achieve. But it took us all day to do it because I did it in little tiny increments.
Yeah.
Like 5 mile an hour at a time. So you did the first sighting moment was 135. And we did 140, then 155, then 165, 175. And eventually we did 181, I think, which equaled the record. And the following run, we 183.5. And I could have done one more run and maybe done 190, but we called it a day. We got our record.
Yeah,
let's go home.
Don't tempt fate. What was the? I mean, the adrenaline with that, Alan, must have been absolutely insane. Were you shattered by the end of the day because of what you've had to put into it?
Totally exhausted.
Yeah,
and people will say, "Oh, yeah, but my CBR 600 does 180."
Yes, it's exactly the same thing.
I mean, the amount of comments I got on Facebook from people saying,
"You're joking."
My Hayabusa Suzuki Cruiser is 180. What achievement's that?
That is ridiculous.
But a homemade bike.
Not with someone on the back and you got a lot more. I mean, that is a lot of responsibility. You know, I've driven at that speed before and I remember not lampposts, it's on a track. I remember everything just going, vroom, 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 but to have someone on the back as well and you've got the responsibility of, you know, that's quite scary, isn't it?
You get tunnel vision with the speed as you go faster. The vibration from the helmet went like this. Now, at one point, the helmet pulled around, it twisted around. I was looking for the air breathing vent.
No.
No.
There's a little slit in the front of my helmet. I wasn't actually looking through the visor. I was looking through the head because the pressure on your face is tremendous at that speed.
I've got sweaty palms just thinking about that. The margin for error at such a high speed on your own anyway, but with someone, your mate, hanging on the back as well, that is frightening. What is it like then when you get off the bike having done that world record and then I'm assuming riding home at a normal speed? I'm assuming it felt like you get off and walk next to the bike when you're doing 70.
It does. When you spend all day approaching 200 miles an hour, 70 feels like walking pace, like absolute walking pace. But the other thing to remember, my Viper bike, it's got one gear. So you put it into gear and it's 0 to 200, one speed. So like just open the throttle. So when you do a comparison to a normal road bike, the normal road bike needs to be in top gear, should be in sixth gear, then pull away and then race me.
I mean, that, if you and, right, we're going to have a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping just to like let me and Ewan and I calm ourselves down.
Yeah.
If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. So, I mean, it's quite a leap backwards now, Alan, in the sense of 183 and a half miles an hour with Henry Cole on your back, breaking all kinds of records to the day that you passed your test. Now, you've already mentioned about getting around on bikes at a certain age, pre-test, and then ending up with a nice license that's already got endorsements on. The test that you took, how did you feel when you passed? I mean, presumably, and this is maybe a big presumption, that you passed first time.
I failed.
all the best people fail.
I failed because I didn't do the emergency stop properly. In the old days, you did a little loop around a circle.
Yeah.
Four left turns, and each turn the instructor would be a different position. And he'd drop his hand, and I didn't see him drop his hand. And I thought he was just an innocent bypasser. So I didn't do my emergency stop. So I failed my emergency stop. But clearly, I literally reapplied straight away and passed the second time round.
Yeah.
But I was a bit flippant. I just thought, I can be riding bikes for 10 years by the time I took my test. So I should be able to ride a bike.
So when it came to that, well, because we spoke to many, many, many people on here, and there's always a, so there's a similar reaction to it, but there's that slight variation of that, the joy that comes from it, the freedom pass that you've got slapped into your hands.
Oh, it's great. You just rip the L plates off straight away.
Like straight away. See you later. Bye. Yeah.
And you go out and get your big... I actually had a Honda 175 when I first passed my test, which that gave me some advice, which I actually think is the best advice that I've ever been given, was start small. When you can ride it flat out all day, then go up the next size.
Sound advice.
Yeah. So I had a 175 Honda, CD 175, and I can ride the pants off that bike. I used to catch up and keep up with my friends on Z1s most of the time. And then you get a CX 500, then you get a GPZ 750, then a GPZ 1100, and I had a CX 500 Turbo. So the evolution of speed and power was linear, rather than go straight to a past test and buying a Z1.
Mm. That makes total sense. Total sense. I mean, you and you've alluded to that before, haven't you? That jumping around of size of bike and thinking, oh, hang on, I'm pretty competent, but what this has got is a bit beyond me right now.
Well, sadly, without bringing the mood right down, there was a kid in my school that passed his test and went got straight away and got like 1,000cc and sadly lost his life because, you know, you're not mature enough. You're not ready for that.
You know,
I was the same as you. I failed on emergency stop first time round. And then as soon as I passed, it was like, yeah, freedom. But I think that's great advice from your dad. Once you can handle what you've got and then just increase it. But what was your favorite bike? I know it's really hard to choose from, but for me, my great memories looking back is like, you know, my TZR125, which I passed my test on. I'll always have really fond memories. It probably wasn't the best bike I've owned whatsoever, but to me, it means a lot. What was the best bike you've owned,
do you think? Do you know what? This might be a bit strange, really, because in the bike I've been, but I actually really, really like my CH500 Turbo.
Yeah.
My Honda, because it was so quirky and ridiculously fast for its size back in the day. It cruised at 135 miles an hour on the autobahns all day long, 500cc bike. But it's just because it had proper fuel injection, a turbocharger, a turbo written all over it, Obra on the front, which is in reverse. So when you come up behind a car, they look in their mirror, they see turbo.
Nice.
Until you come flying past.
It's just a fun bike to ride, you know. I see it's like riding an elastic band because the turbo lag was quite prominent. So you used to whack the throttle open, put the front brake on to boost the turbo, and let the front brake off. It got off like a rocket. It was as quick as the GPZ 1100 up to about 120.
Just up to 120. Alan, have you bought, obviously in the long history of bikes that you've owned and tinkered with and rebuilt, do you buy these direct from manufacturers at times?
What do you mean by direct from manufacturers? Yeah,
because the picture in my head basically is you walking into a showroom and somebody trying to tell you about a bike I think you can stop there, pal, because there's nothing about this bike that you can tell. And then you just nod and say to go, yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, thanks very much. Weirding it out, knowing it's not going to look like this very shortly.
I think today most people know me.
Yeah.
But when I was buying my bikes when I was younger, I bought a brand new CX500, regular CX500. Of course, back in 1978, there was no internet, was there, nothing like that. If you wanted to get in the papers, you had to fill out a form, send it off to the motorcycle news with a colour picture of your bike. And so it didn't happen with it. Because now these days everyone's on social media, they all know. Yeah. Everyone knows everybody, don't they?
Yeah. I was reading your latest article in MCN as well, because I mean, just touching on what that kind of institution is, obviously it was in the transition from people actually picking up the physical aspect of it, being able to now read it on your iPad. That seems like a relationship that you've had a really kind of there's a real mutual respect there. There's a respect for your oceans of knowledge with regards to what it is. And it's a platform there that whatever you're riding as a biker, most of us will pick up MCN and have a flick through it, won't we?
Yeah, it's great doing my column. I enjoy writing the column. It's nice to talk about stuff in print as well as just putting it online as a Facebook post. I can put a post on Facebook and I'll get 600,000 views in a day from one post, which is a lot. Really, when you think how many people buy the motorcycle news, or do they get 600,000? I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, that print media is a slightly different beast now, and it's something just going off that viewership and what we spoke about with the numbers for YouTube, because you and I have spoken to people across the kind of motorcycling world, and ones that you put in the bracket of influencers or you put in the bracket of content creators, and we ask them, how far ahead have you planned? Some have planned 6 months, some have planned a year, some are a bit more, I don't know, we'll see what happens. That smile on your face suggests that maybe you're not a six-month planner.
I don't plan at all. I've been a bit quiet recently on YouTube. I was sort of having a bit of a rest from it just for a little while. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to get into a situation where I'm just making a video for the hell of it.
Yeah.
That's why you're authentic, isn't it? Because you do something because you want to do it. And I think people who put stuff out just for the sake of it, you can see through that. But in terms of what you've built, and you know, obviously you've said you're not planning too far ahead, but is there any itch you're yet to scratch? Because I don't know how you're going to beat that V10 Viper. I mean, in terms of a crazy build, is there anything you can tell us that's in the pipeline, or something you've imagined or you've dreamt of and got your notepad out and go, right, I'm building that one day? What's going on?
I've been asked this a lot recently, but I have to be really inspired. Nothing's inspired me at the moment. I need to see something that I think, wow, yeah, I could do this.
Or you need someone to say you can't do that, and then you're telling people you can.
Yeah, I've actually made over I think 55 or 60 bikes I've made since I started doing it in sort of 1996, I suppose it all started, really.
Do you find your friends phone you up and go, oh, listen, my bike's making a funny noise. Have a listen to this. And they get the phone up. What's
every
wrong
day.
With the
engine? It's not any friends. It's anybody.
Anyone.
I don't look at my messages quite often, but Facebook messages, can you rebuild this? Can you do this? Can you make my carburetor leak clean? Can you rebuild my bike? Can you rebuild my engine? Can you restore this? You know, they must think I'm a multinational company with 15 people working like that. It's just me and my little shed. I'm not a business in that respect.
Alan, you say little shed. I'm picturing a place that's got... Normally, we'd ask about the kind of the stable of bikes that may be ongoing for our lovely, lovely guests. But that sense of... I'm picturing a shed with bikes in, but also just an endless array of bits that you might need, whether it's part of an engine, whether it's a carburetor, whether it's handlebars. There's always, maybe, and you'll get a bike in, you'll look around and kind of go, yep, that's exactly what that bit's been waiting for.
I will say these days with eBay, I tend to sort of not hoard stuff like I used to.
Okay.
I just get what I need when I need it rather than thinking, have I got it in the shed? I've got a few sort of choice items I have kept. I mostly cleared out a lot of my clutter, so to make space to store my bikes nicely.
You say it's cleared out, but if you went into your shed now, have you got enough parts to look at with your brain and go, yeah, got that, I've got that, I can build a bike out of that. I bet you've got enough to build a bike.
I guess so. I've still got some spare aeroplane cylinders.
There you go.
I mean, do you get those off eBay?
I actually did get them off eBay. But what happened, I was at Salon Prix with my SS100 V-twin. I won best in show or something with that bike. And Steve Paris was a judge. And he said, what are you going to make next year for the show for next year? I said, I'll make the biggest V-twin. Just like that. And so as soon as I got home, I went on eBay and I typed in big cylinders and they came up. And they were listed as big cylinders. And they're off a Pratt & Whitney Wasp, which is like a Dakota DC-3 airplane. 6-inch bore, 6-inch stroke.
Sorry, my... Purell brains looking at typing in big cylinders and seeing what you get on Google. Okay, that's not quite what I was after, but yeah, tremendous.
If you said big jugs, it might be different, but that's the American phrase.
Don't worry, that's in his search history already.
Right, Alan, we've got, before we get into final questions, I mean, this is just fascinating and mind-blowing and scary in parts, given the types of speeds that you've managed to quite laconically just, 183 miles an hour with Henry on the back, absolutely perfect. And Henry was obviously glowing about you as his partner in crime. We're going to have a quick fire round of questions, if you don't mind, given speed is something that you are synonymous with in ginormous engines. We're going to give you 60 seconds to answer as many of these questions as you can. And then we'll tot up your score at the end. I mean, there might be a prize for the winner at the end of the series. If so, we'll get back in touch and give you, I don't know, a day with Ewan. Whether that's motivation to do well, I don't know. But
I'll tell you what the prize could be. We can give you a broken motorbike, mine, and you can fix it for us. Perfect. Right. Okay, here we go. Quick fire.
Hang on. Let me get the stopwatch up.
Stopwatch ready.
We've got to maintain an air of some form of professionalism. Right, Ewan. So it'll be, Alan, Ewan will ask a question, I'll ask a question, and vice versa, until we finish or until you get bored. So don't worry about that either. Right, 3, 2, 1, go.
Who was your motorcycling hero growing up?
Barry Sheen.
What posters did you have on your bedroom wall?
GPZ 1100 B2.
Japanese bikes or British bikes?
Japanese.
Why?
Because their engineering is very, very well refined.
Okay, who is your favourite Spice Girl?
I don't know. I haven't got one.
Just say scary.
Scary.
Do you like Formula One?
I don't. I like the engine technology. I don't follow the racing.
Norton or Triumph?
Norton.
Chinese takeaway or Indian takeaway?
Neither.
TT or MotoGP?
TT.
Do you like coriander?
Yes.
I think we know the answer to this one. Barry Sheen or Kenny Roberts?
Barry Sheen.
Kawasaki or Suzuki?
Kawasaki.
Why?
Because I've got a lot of them.
Favourite breed of dog?
Ridgeback.
That's it. That's
no, come
it.
On. One more. I need
go
the
on
next
then.
One.
Go on then.
I want
go
to
on.
Know how a
go
mechanical on. God, how he eats his bacon sandwiches with brown sauce or ketchup?
Ketchup.
Right, let me do a quick talk. I mean, this is as arbitrary as it comes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 17 questions answered there in a minute. I think, as as scores go, Alan, I think that's pretty good. Round of applause, please, Ewan, for Alan Milliard.
Definitely. That was absolutely brilliant. Right, Adam, we have got our famous final question for you, and I think yours is going to be totally bonkers. We want to know about your idyllic ride. In your mind, you could be riding any bike anywhere in the world. With whom are you riding, and are you listening to any music? So your dream fantasy ride, where would you ride? What bike would you be on? Who would you be with? And what music would be your soundtrack?
The Isle of Man TT Circuit.
Nice.
On my Flying Milliard with my boys.
Oh, nice. Any music?
No, you listen to the engine. Why would you have music to distract you?
There we go.
That's an amazing answer. That is an amazing answer. So for you, Alan, is that sense, because I love listening to music, and we've had people that suggest music or say or dismiss it out of hand.
It shouldn't be allowed. It's a big distraction. You're listening to your gearbox, you're listening to the engine, you're listening to the suspension and the tweeting birds going by in the wind. Why would you need music?
And given your experience and knowledge of them, you must be able to hear the proverbial pin drop of what's going on in each and every engine that you've ever sat on.
I listen to everything. You're analysing it all the time. I've ridden my Flying Milliard 9,800 miles on the road, and you're constantly listening to it in case it goes wrong, because you don't want it to go wrong. It's never actually ever gone wrong. It's worked perfectly reliable, which is really cool.
So you know straight away, if a tap hit or anything is slightly out, you'll go, oh, right, I'll deal with that when I get home.
You can back off, stop, have a little investigation, sort it out.
I would just ride it till it breaks. I wouldn't know what. I'd just go, oh, that sounds a bit louder than normal. That's cool.
That's the biggest mistake people make. They just wind the throttle, like, turn the radio up.
Ignore it. It'll be fine. I'll just ride straight through this.
Yeah.
And you mentioned there about riding with your boys, Alan, and what your dad's passed down to you. I mean, is it in the kind of lineage? Is it just with being a Milliard? Is motor mechanics something in the blood, do you reckon?
Yeah, my dad was a design engineer making cranes. Mm. He used to ride motorbikes, but only to get boards back and forth to work. But I think it's engineering's in my blood, yeah, definitely.
Well, I tell you what, I mean, this has been, as I said, both frightening, fascinating, illuminating, and it really does put you in your place, Ewan, doesn't it? I mean, the next time I'll be out with my headphones out going, is it meant to make that noise?
I'm also slightly embarrassed at my Draper Tools socket set downstairs where I think I've got the lot. I mean, I clearly have. I've got a lot to learn.
I've got this. I've got this from a microphone. That's literally all I've got to change the head.
You don't. It's a misconception that you need a lot of tools. You need a lathe probably, and maybe a milling machine, and a few spanners and a few sockets and an array of hammers and some files.
Yeah, but Alan, it's all very well saying I don't need that many tools. I need to know what to do with those tools, though, and that's where our brains are wired differently. But I'm gonna learn. I'm gonna learn more. You've inspired me.
What I tell people is practice cutting bread. If you can cut bread 2 millimeters thick all the way down, then you can cut metal the same.
That, I mean, you know, I mean, Ewan and I are going to give that a go. But unfortunately, I mean, from a couple of tools talking to a genius, this is sadly for full chat this week, powered by Bikeshaw, UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance, and of course, so much more.
A huge thank you to today's guest. It certainly has been a life lesson for me. It's just been brilliant chatting to him.
Staggering.
Mr. Alan Milliard. And of course, if you haven't checked out his YouTube, get on there because you can see all of his crazy builds and all the fantastic work he does. So check him out on YouTube.
Thank you.
Alan, it's been an absolute pleasure. Please don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube, where, of course, Alan is ruling things, so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
As ever, thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, goodbye.